Hello, welcome, and thanks for tuning in to the 11th edition of Culture with me, Robert Band. And this week, we're doing all the hard work while you sit back and relax over the festive period. We're picking out all the best bits from culture so far for you to enjoy. So if you've missed anything yet, now here's your chance to catch up. We'll bring you the best of our Midori House sessions and look back to that lovely interview with Emmy the Great, where she was dressed as a fish.
Yeah, that's my scales.
Yep.
And I'm like basically a fish from Ponyo.
It is like that. It's a Studio Ghibli type of costume.
I got it in Japan, and I'm going to wear purple leggings, but I didn't bring them today.
We'll also be hanging out with the men behind the Nintendo Orchestra and popping over to Collect Mag in Adelaide for a taste of what we've been covering in the world of media.
And I'm a big believer that creativity can come from anywhere. And I think in this day and age, you know, the connectivity of good ideas is so easy. You don't need to be in the core of it. You don't need to be in New York or San Francisco or London.
And who could forget the slightly insane Tokyo Commercials Festival?
It's the craziest event you can think of to make people pay to watch commercials.
Plus some snippets from our favourite studio guests, and what better way to see you through the holidays than a montage of the weird and wonderful 1 minute of sound. Brace yourselves. That's here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, here on Monocle 24. And don't forget, here's what we promised in week one. The idea of the Culture programme is that we make you feel like you've seen, heard, watched, attended and danced to the finest and most exciting events in the world's cultural calendar. We'll be speaking to film directors, songwriters, authors, artists, newspaper editors, gallerists, illustrators, auteurs, producers, publishers, and the odd over-enthusiastic amateur at art gallery openings and pop concerts to illuminate the present and crystal ball the future of culture in all its forms. Well, that's what we'd said we'd do, and I think we've done okay, but you can probably write in and tell us. So let's kick things off with one of our favourite sessions that we've hosted here at Midori House so far. This is the beautiful Norwegian songstress Anna Brun, who has mesmerised us here at Midori when she came in to do a session for Edition 5. This is her doing Do You Remember?
Do you remember the late morning when we went back to bed? When we found our first position and every muscle rested? I do remember that I already knew it was the last time. The last time for first positions. The last time you're being mine. Do you remember the scars I showed you, the stories I told you? How I always said forever when you asked me to stay true. Do you remember how we forgot how to smile at each other, to believe that the other wants only what's good for you?
That was Anna Brun playing Do You Remember for us here at Midori House for Culture with me, Robert Bound. And thank God I am in the studio on my own, because it's the holiday season and you're not here. Today we're celebrating the best of culture so far, and we thought it would be just mighty fine to revisit some of the people who we've enjoyed welcoming into our studio. We loved, for example, having the director of My Week with Marilyn, Simon Curtis, and the author of This Bleeding City, Alex Preston, in our Truth and Fiction special.
If you look at modern culture at the moment, there is a sort of crisis in fiction.
Yeah.
That I don't know if it's a reality TV age, but you think of the two big films last year, for example, The King's Speech and Social Network, were both...
Well, and 127 Hours.
Completely.
And the fight. You know, it was
completely
an
right.
age of reality yeah. hunger, isn't it? It's extraordinary.
Completely. And that somehow people almost don't want to take the risk of fiction or something, or maybe we've run out of stories or something.
Perhaps it's that the audience, you know, that weird stamp from a true life story, which, you know, with all due respect, with a man in the room who's made from a true life story. But it's true that people want these real life stories. People want, I think maybe it's that life is so complex that it's so difficult to get a hook on even an idea of the truth, that the both the audience and the artists need a way of finding an authority in truth.
Well, let me ask you then, Simon, how responsible do you have to be to that truth? Obviously, you said it's a dramatisation of Colin Clark's memoir, so you've obviously got the middleman there already. But I mean, how responsible do you have to be to the truth of his book?
Well, all I can say is you do your best. You know,
yeah.
I mean, a wise person once said about filmmaking that there's the script version of a film, there's the shoot version of the film, and there's the editing version of the film. And if it's based on a book, before those three, there's the source book version of a film, you know, and things inevitably evolve. You know, on the day you don't quite get that scene, or that line isn't delivered as well as you hoped, and so on. But all I can say is, you know, we did our best to tell the truth, and there was so much... So photographic evidence of Marilyn's time in London. So, you know, our starting point was to be as authentic as possible. But obviously there's a process you go through, you know, and you know, no one actually knows.
That was Simon Curtis, director of My Week with Marilyn, and Alex Preston, author of This Bleeding City. And then there was the charming Matt Wolfe, theatre critic for the International Herald Tribune, who came to talk to us all about performance and why we keep going out when we could just stay in.
Well, in a sense, it's interesting because the whole social media explosion is about sharing, isn't it? We share our friends on Facebook. We share the things we've read. We join LinkedIn. We do all of this. And yet it's somehow behind a protective carapace of the computer. And I think the more that that happens contradictorily, the more people want to burst out of that and actually go out and see what it is that their mates on Facebook are talking about. Or what improv is James Corden going to do tonight at One Man, Two Governors when it gets to the hummus sandwich bit? And we all know now that that's kind of ingrained in that particular performance. And so that has spiraled off into a kind of stand-up life of its own, which is going to be different every time he does the show. And it's the uniqueness of it, I think, and the sense of unpredictability.
That was Matt Wolfe, theatre critic for the International Herald Tribune, with a note or two on why on earth we keep going out. Not to mention the glorious UK broadcasting great Trevor Dann in our radio spectacular for Edition 9.
I think that too much commercial radio around the world has come to be run by people who may understand money but don't understand radio. And I think too much public service broadcasting, speech broadcasting, has come to be run by people with a very narrow idea of what journalism means. There's too much kind of focus on bulletins and facts and reports and analysis and people telling us in a rather old school kind of way what we should think. And I think radio at its best is about a conversation. And I don't just mean a phone-in. I think it's about, you know, I make something and I stick it on Audioboo or Mixcloud or Soundcloud, and then you make something and Matt makes something and we all kind of listen to it. And it's not so much, I don't think, anymore about us being broadcasted at.
I think also people, listeners, use all their different types of media for different reasons now. And there are still a large amount of people who might be listening to NRJ in France or Z100 in New York or Capital in the UK, where actually they just want to stream music. They don't really have to think about that; they can just turn on and consume. But a larger and growing chunk of people are also tuning around the dial, getting services online to fulfil personal needs. And that might be because they've got a very specialist music interest, or you know, they might be a farmer and they want to get particular information about that, which they can do so now. Whereas previously, constrained spectrum, i.e. there's only a certain number of FM or AM licences in any country, meant that you couldn't get down to that level.
I hope it's not, we can't be self-indulgent, but I did want to ask you both why you were attracted to coming into a radio station that you might not have heard of and come in and talk about the medium that you're both involved in and that you love.
Well, I can answer that very simply by saying that you represent all that's great about the audio and radio industry, which is you're a new method of distribution. You know, you're a creator, a producer, you're a kind of aggregator, you're a new distribution channel. And you are absolutely at that cutting edge of creating what is a really exciting new industry. It's got a very old name. It's called radio. It's kind of a century old, but it's very modern and very cool. And I think we're all, you know, very lucky to be still in it.
That was broadcasting legend Trevor Dann. And then we also interviewed some musicians rather than them just singing for us. This was Anna Bruhn, who talked to us about running her own label in our independent record label theme show.
I've done the independent thing all the way, and it's been very good for me. It's been good for my creative process.
Are you a good boss to yourself?
I think I've...
Have you ever threatened to sack yourself?
Yeah, I guess.
Have you ever sat on one side of the table smoking a cigar and then had to sit on the other side going, okay, I'll make three albums for you?
Yeah, I think my problem has been that I haven't really realised that I'm the boss sometimes, that I actually
can... That's a good position to be in, I think.
That I actually can say no and say yes and all these things, so... I guess it's the, you know, the good girl problem, good girl syndrome.
Have you got a good work ethic?
Yeah, I do.
Would you give yourself a pay rise if you were the boss?
I give myself good things that makes touring better and, you know, more, like, a little bit better hotels and a little bit better travelling. No morning flights, you know, those kind of things.
No, God.
No, God.
God forbid. Is it still great being on an independent label, or do you ever kind of wish that everything was taken care for by sort of EMI or by, you know, Warner Brothers or something?
I think there are moments when I see that I would want that. It's moments when I feel that it would be nice to someone just take all the responsibility so I could just focus on the music. But at the same time, there's so many good sides of being independent because you can always choose your own tempo, you choose the deadlines, you choose the form you want to release anything in, and especially the luxury of actually be able to plan your time and just... Nobody could tell me to go on tour for 6 months. It's always my decision.
That was Anna Bruhn telling it like it is when you're an artist and a record label owner at the same time. And on that same show was one of our coolest kids on the block, Gilda Luec from Kitsune in Paris.
We started the music label at the worst time. Because, yeah, like at the time we were starting, it's at the time that the music business was start to collapse, which is actually really collapsing because I think it's been the market been divided by 10 into the time we were starting. But the passion is one thing, and I believe also if you do, like, having a good proposal, I think you can, like, create your own space onto the market and build, like, which we are doing actually with the music label, where we are developing each year and growing up are, like, when the music business is, like, getting down. So I think which makes us believe that we are making the good choice and proposing the good project, maybe.
And is there a kind of model that you followed, or is it just literally this is what we like and we're going to stick out our necks and release this stuff? Is that about as much as you can do? Trust your instincts and trust your taste?
On top of I like the project and I like the artist, I like the song, I need to see and believe that it will at some point have some possible income in a way, like compared to what we invest into it. You can't risk that much as it used to be the case. So you need to be sure that it is making sense economically and that you give the maximum chance to get some return to the investment. So it's not only about passion, like 100%, I will say.
That was our friend Gilda from Kitsune in Paris. And who forget the aptly named Emmy the Great, living up to a name, who came in dressed as a fish.
What's touring like? Where have you been recently that you really love and you want to tell us about?
Wrexham.
Yeah, who needs San Francisco?
We've literally been around the UK, Scotland, Ireland and New York in the last month. But Wrexham has stood out because we played this venue and the Zombies, the band The Zombies, were going to play in the next month, as was Gwar. Do you remember that band?
Gwar.
They're like a gore monster. They dress as monsters.
Oh, okay.
From like the 80s and 90s. They're like... metal glam monster band, and I'm pretty sure Sister Hazel was playing as well. I was like,
it's quite
what?
An amazing lineup. It's quite a they literally just put some names of pop groups in a bag and shook it.
What is this fantastic place where all these bands still exist? I was very surprised that the Zombies were playing there and not like the Royal Festival Hall, but obviously Wrexham is where people are going these days to play shows.
It's the go-to.
Exactly.
And talking of Emmy, here's a song that she performed especially for us here at Midori House. called Dinosaur Sex.
I think I see the future when I sleep. The sky splits like an almond under feet. Skin is peeling off of us in sheets. I think I see the future when I sleep. And power stations shiver and they weep. They bleed onto the fields and kill the wheat. Sea of clouds is billowing in heat. Oh, harvest comes and babies born with teeth. And skin is peeling off of us in sheets. I think I see the future when I sleep. And dinosaur sex, that's a nothing. And maybe we will lead to nothing. And dinosaur sex, that's nothing. But we will lead as far as we can lead. And dinosaur sex, that's nothing. And maybe we will lead to nothing. And dinosaur sex, that's nothing. But we will lead as far as we can lead.
That was a super great Emmy the Great with Dinosaur Sex. You're listening to The Best of Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're back for some more cultural treats after this.
Avant-garde.
Avant-garde.
I want to set up something new, not copying somebody.
Basically, we just wanted to express ourselves and don't think too much of other people.
Sometimes it needs to push a boundary.
To see the smoke clearing, but it's a lifetime thing, you know.
You actually have to find something to truly challenge, and that's an avant-garde.
Watch it on www.theavantgardediaries.com.
We have 7 Monocle shops around the world, in London, New York, Hong Kong, Beijing, Osaka, and 2 in Tokyo, where you can find a full range of Monocle products perfect for a Christmas gift for your loved ones. We're now carrying the latest in Monocle collaborations, including Drake's winter gloves and scarves, Anderson Anderson sailor sweaters, Valextra grip wallets, Todd's passport holders, and of course, the Monocle 24 Revo radio, so you can listen to us in high fidelity sound. So at home or away, drop by a Monocle shop. We'd love to show you around.
Welcome back to The Best of Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Now, there's one thing we always sculpt out some time for on the show. It's the art world. Where else would you find the best parties in this cultural world depleted of late of some of its fun? So what better way to kickstart the first show than a trip to London's Frieze Art Fair, just down the road from Midori House itself. October saw the return of Frieze Week, when London's contemporary galleries respond to the art fair itself by doing their makeup, hitching up their skirts, and putting on their hottest shows of the year. At London's Listen Gallery, Corey Archangel, a multidisciplinary young artist from New York, filled the space with Photoshop colour test prints, silkscreen close-ups of a Roy Lichtensteiner-like polo shirt, a homage to a Kelly Clarkson pop song, and this bouncing, a Nintendo basketball game hacked to ensure Shaq never shoots a basket.
And it's been programmed that he never gets the ball in the hoop. So we're just watching Shaquille O'Neal, you know, miss continually.
Lots of people know this, but some people won't, that you did start off computer hacking.
The internet was the place where I first started to make public artwork. And, you know, in playing around with computers, I had developed lots of different ways to manipulate them. And the original definition of the word is one that actually fits with what I do. It means they're like messing with or playing with or playing practical jokes or like gluing two different things together in a messy way to produce a kind of like funny or weird result, you know. And so that is kind of what I do. And it's weirdly enough like what I do even if I'm not on the computer. I think that that metaphor could stand for a lot of different things. It's a good way to describe a lot of fine art, weirdly enough, you know.
No better place to see the look on people's faces as they respond to acres of art than at Frieze itself. Co-founder Amanda Sharp is still amazed at how London's changed. She remembers when it all used to be fields.
We started 20 years ago, there were 30 people in the pub. That was the whole art world. Now, 70,000 people through one fair in 7 days. That's a very substantial sea change. For the galleries in the fair, they'll know by 3 o'clock on the opening day whether or not it's worked for them. For us, the real benchmark of success, I suppose, is happy people. So you see how it affects next year, whether all the galleries want to come back, whether you get the same number of people who want to visit the fair or more. And you know what? You can just smell it in the air.
Frieze is known too for its curatorial ambitions, its things not for sale. That bit of the fair that can comment on the other bit being a shop.
I'm Sarah McCrory and I'm the curator of Frieze Projects and Frieze Film at the fair and the Frieze Foundation overall. Matthew Slotover and Amanda Sharp, when they started it, wanted to include works by artists who maybe their work doesn't fit so neatly into a gallery booth, or perhaps to allow artists to make a more significant project or try out an idea that questions the context of the fair. It is a trade fair and it is set up for that, but you also have artists, curators, museum directors, and lots of people are looking for what's happening and different ideas.
There's nothing like an opening morning stampede of art-hungry millionaires to excite the appetite of an art advisor. Lisa Schiff's just that, and wouldn't miss Frieze for, well, £1 million.
Frieze is happening in London, and the only other fair that happens in a centre like that is the Armoury. When you're collecting all the time and you're really active, sometimes it's like tiring to have another art fair, but you cannot ignore a fair in London. It's the one time of year for sure you're going to come here, you're going to go to all the museums, you're going to catch up with all the gallerists, you're going to see what studios you can. You kind of have to come and see what's happening here. I feel obligated to come here.
Art advisors have interesting jobs, pointing buyers towards the blue chip, blue period Picassos, while keeping an eye on the emerging and the underground to help bag a bargain that'll age as gracefully and profitably as a Freud nude, but at a snip.
I think you have to be very particular about what you're buying, and I think you have to be really smart about what you're buying and thoughtful, and you have to follow the market to understand it.
Like any futures market, it's based on intelligence, gossip, and a bit of a gamble. But oil on canvas may be more reliable than half the economies of Europe. Art is an industry in which the artists actually make things. Perhaps it's a market that could teach us all a lesson.
Painting is still hands down the most marketable medium. And if fixed assets stay in a good position, then I think the market will stay healthy the way that it has been doing so during this really uncertain time.
Those are the good and the great of the Frieze Art Fair in London. You're listening to The Best of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Still to come in part two, we travel around the world to poke our cultural nose in some of our favourite spots. We'll be flying off to Collect magazine in Adelaide, the Tokyo Commercials Festival and New York's veritable old stager full of bright new tunes, other music, as well as enjoying the dulcet tones of Simon Prosser in our book corner and indulging in the ultimate minute of sound. What better way to enjoy your festive break than with The Best of Culture here on Monocle 24? Now, we strive to bring you a good media tale in our weekly slice of cultural joy from Al Jazeera in the Balkans to isolated radio stations in Alaska. And this was one of our favourites. Reporter Annie Hastewell went to meet the founders of Collect Mag down under in Adelaide.
We're overlooking Rundle Street, which is essentially the fashion sort of precinct of Adelaide. It's on weekends and after hours, it becomes the restaurant and fashion area, but during the week, it's a really nice little village.
Adam Johnson is Collect Mag's designer.
Did you want to come and have a squeeze at the office?
Love to.
He and editor Josh Fanning and journalist Farron Foster put the magazine together here in their first floor office above the boutiques and cafes of Adelaide's East End.
A cup of tea?
Oh, yes, please.
The three are young, creative, and ambitious enough to launch an international magazine, but without feeling the need to move from where they're comfortable, their own hometown and their own neighbourhood.
In my particular field, the creative field, it's one of those things that's the first thing people do. They establish themselves, get to a certain level of seniority in their chosen craft, and then they scurry off to the bigger cities. And I'm a big believer that creativity can come from anywhere. And I think in this day and age, you know, the connectivity of good ideas is so easy. You don't need to be in the core of it. You don't need to be in New York or San Francisco or London.
Sitting in Adelaide, you find wonderful people and amazing things. And I think that's what made us want to do the magazine. We all know about great things and we wanted to share that with people.
Well, let's look at the magazine. It is bite-sized indeed. It's probably about a quarter the size of a normal magazine.
Half a size. A5 is generally half an A4, and A4 is pretty much what newsstands around the world are built for. So we definitely disappear if we're on a mainstream newsstand. So that's essentially why we don't distribute largely through mainstream avenues. We handpick our stockists.
And the edition we're looking at, the issue we're looking at, has a trowel on the front.
Maybe AJ can decide why we put a hand trowel on the cover.
Well, all of our covers to date have had an iconic thing on the front. And the first issue was a watch, and the second issue was a microphone. We'd find something iconic that's existed for a long time and hasn't changed. And this was Cyclone, who are an Australian manufacturer of garden products, and they designed and built this product, you know, a very long time ago, and it hasn't changed. And I think that's a big part of what the magazine is about, is things that are built to last.
The search for thoroughly authentic local products worthy of Collect Mag's front page turned up another Adelaide gem, the long-established Rossi Boot Factory.
They make shoes, and they make them with a lifetime guarantee. And for us, that's jackpot, you know, like that's the sort of company that we want to work with. So they didn't have the appropriate ad copy for us, so we made it ourselves. And I think that's kind of a bit pretentious, but it's also, they called us in 2 weeks later and they said, well, here's your ad. We've blown it up to A2 poster. We've hung it on our wall. It's the first, well, it's the only communication we've sort of done in 100 years where we've been able to measure how much influence it's had on the market. We've just been taking phone calls and emails, and it's amazing. We set out to make Collect for Adelaide, but without the limitations of just being about South Australia or being about Adelaide. We wanted to show like-minded people in Adelaide the world, and show them that Adelaide is a part of that world. And that's important. But 3 issues in, we get a call from probably the best or the biggest magazine, a specialty store in Australia, Mag Nation, and they want to stock our magazine. So all of a sudden I'm like, oh, really? You know it's about Adelaide, right? How are you going to sell it? And they're like, no, it's a great mag, doesn't matter. Doesn't matter what it's about, it's a good magazine.
And they put it on their counter.
Yeah. So, I mean, I've been spiralling since that stage, and I mean, I sent them to Stockholm, and they sell them in a beautiful little store called Papercut, and they love it. And they said, yeah, we'll support it, it's a great magazine, and same with Hong Kong. And it's just hard for us to sort of catch up, and I think that's what AJ and I, financially, we're trying to work out. How do you pay to send 20 magazines? Like, that's what they mean when they say print is dead, like $95 to send 20 magazines that have a cover price of $5. So, yeah, we're working in a weird limbo world.
It's pretty naive of us, though, but that's all right.
I think that's right. I'm from a publishing background, and I started with naivety, and I think you'd never do something if you weren't a little bit naive. If you actually knew what was involved and the financial costs and the, you know, the heartache and the sweat, you wouldn't do it. But because you don't know, I think that's what excites people, to do something new, and that's what excites us.
That was Annie Haswell reporting on Collect Mag in Adelaide. You're listening to the best of Monocle 24's Culture Show. Well, between us and our team of reporters, we've attended a fair few opening nights so far, but this one struck us as the oddest. Here's what happened when Kenji Hall, our man in Tokyo, stayed up all night at the Commercials Festival in that hometown of his.
My name is Jean-Christian Bouvier. I'm a French guy living in Japan, and I'm the producer of The Night of the Editors. The Night of the Editors, in French, it's La Nuit des Publivores. In Japanese, it's Sekai no Sien Festival. It's the craziest event you can think of to make people pay to watch commercials. Who would think about that? Well, usually at home, it's commercial time, you go to take a beer in the kitchen, but you would never pay to watch commercial. But the Night of the Editors, it's so much fun that people pay to come, and they come again every year. It starts at 10 in the evening, it ends at 5:30 in the morning, 500 commercials from all over the world on a giant screen with live bands, performance. It's the greatest event, it's a big circus. 1,000 people tonight, and maybe the same tomorrow.
It starts in Fukuoka.
It starts in Fukuoka.
And then where does it go after that?
It goes to Hiroshima, Kagoshima, Amakusa. You never heard of Amakusa. It's a small place, only one movie house, 90 seats, sold out. We go to Okinawa, to Nagoya, about 20 cities, from Okinawa to Hokkaido.
Where are we? We're standing in the lobby.
Yeah, we are in the lobby of Milanoichi, in the heart of Kabukicho in Tokyo. And it's the biggest movie house in Tokyo, 1,000 seats. And I have people who come and sell coffee, sell crepe, we sell wine. When people want to sell things, I say, okay, come, but don't come to make money. Come not to lose money, but to make people happy.
And what's the entertainment for tonight? In between, you know, you have breaks.
We have 5 breaks.
Okay.
But with a breaks means live performance, drag queen in the lobby, fantastic band. The Kansas City band was on stage for 8 minutes. They will play in the lobby. I have another band at the opening of the third part. Then the Coralidas, our staff, they have a nice band too before the lottery.
They're the ones who we heard coming into the,
yes.
into the entrance.
But
here.
They will play a different style on the stage. And before the last part, all the musicians who are left, they come together and they have a big jam session on stage.
And what time will that be at?
4:30 in the morning. Good morning, Tokyo.
Tell me, how many countries these commercials have come from?
About 40 countries. When I do the editing, I'd be very careful. Not only French, not only English, but also from Africa, from Serbia, from Croatia, from Russia, any country you never think of.
And do the commercials translate? Because they're in different languages.
Yes, but we put Japanese subtitles on all of them, and it's a lot of work. Usually it's a commercial, it's an art for people who watch TV. So it's very middle class, and middle class is average all over the world. It's good fun. It's not hypo. No long speeches. It's a handmade festival. Maybe if you think of the money spent to make these 500 commercials, it's more than 10 Hollywood movies. The money involved in making these commercials makes the most expensive show in the world.
That was Kenzie Hall reporting. You're listening to The Best of Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. We're off to New York after this.
Avant-garde.
Avant-garde.
I want to set up something new, not copying somebody.
Basically, we just wanted to express ourselves and don't think too much of other people.
Sometimes it needs to push a boundary.
To see the smoke clearing, but it's a lifetime thing, you know.
You actually have to find something to truly challenge, and that's an avant-garde.
Watch it on www.theavantgardediaries.com.
Section D is Monocle's weekly design show, hosted by me, Hugo MacDonald. It's a show about the things that we live with, the stories behind them, and the industries around them. From the paperclips on your desk, to the furniture in your home, the shops on your doorstep, to the signs that direct you to them.
What Japan offers up in terms of graphic design and architecture, you just cannot miss it. You have to go.
Section D is about craft, design, fashion, architecture and graphics in all their guises.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24.
Oh, welcome back to The Culture Show with me, Rob Bell, on Monocle 24. Hi. So nearly every week we've been to record and bookshops to get some recommendations from the people with a passion for it. From São Paulo to Copenhagen to Sydney, we've checked in with a fair few local know-it-alls. One of our favourites was in New York, where Aisha Spears went to meet the people behind Other Music.
My name's Josh Maydell. I'm one of the owners of Other Music. We're a record store in downtown Manhattan. Been here for about 16 years now. I mean, we have a pretty broad selection of underground music. You know, when we opened, there was really nobody in New York at that time bringing in all the great imports, really keeping track of all the American indie labels. That was a very vibrant time in the mid-90s for independent music around the world. We have everything from classic folk, country, psychedelic albums from the 60s and 70s, avant jazz and classical, to a lot of modern stuff. We get all sorts of customers coming into this store. I mean, our core is definitely New York-based music collectors, big music fans, and we have tons of new music coming in here every week, and one of our most popular features is this weekly email update we put out, where we review 15 or 20 new releases every week. So we have a lot of people who just stay up on music, and they come in here every week seeing what we're recommending, what we're excited about, picking up new stuff. We also have a ton of tourists who've been coming here for years. For people who are really into sound fidelity and they're listening in a nice stereo, a CD is the best way to get digital music still. But that's rapidly changing, and we are selling more and more vinyl these days. You know, incrementally, we still sell a ton of CDs, but now, for the first time since we've been open, a big new release can sell more on LP than it will on CD. I'm simple as a matter of fact. Punch in the nose, don't overreact. Our biggest seller was the new Wilco album. You know, that's a band that we've been supporting for a long time. They were on a major label, now they run their own label. But they're just like a real kind of bread and butter indie alternative group. The easiest to set free. Our second biggest seller was Twin Sister, who is a new local band. They're a real, like, sort of internet sensation band for the last couple years. They had some download-only music that became pretty popular on the blogs. Really good local band who just had their first really proper full album release on Domino, which is a UK-based label, but they do have a New York office. That's a band that we've sort of supported for a long time. They actually played a record release in store here last week when the album came out. A bunch of fans came out. The last three in our top 10 were all kind of interesting reissues. The first one was this new record on Light in the Attic by an artist named Shin Jong-hyun. He's a Korean artist who's been playing, I guess he's a superstar in Korea. I wasn't familiar with him until I saw this collection. Psychedelic guitar pop. He's a guitar player, and it varies from vocal pop, stuff that he did in the early 60s through kind of more spacey, pretty trippy stuff. And he's very popular in Korea, but it's pretty eclectic. Really great collection.
Oh,
thing about working in this job is getting to hear new music, you know, getting to hear people doing something you haven't done before, whether it's a reissue or something new. It happens every day. That's why we come to work here.
That was Aisha Spears speaking to Josh Madel of Other Music in Manhattan. And you're listening to The Best of Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. And we've met some pretty cool people in the show, but this guy has to have one of the most amazing and unusual jobs in the world. Back in show 3, we met up with Koji Kondo, who's the composer for the Nintendo Orchestra. Anniversary, 25th birthday. Congratulations. I wanted to know how your work has changed in 25 years. The idea from going from very basic pixels and very basic sounds to suddenly now having a symphonic score for Zelda.
Yes, as you say, when we started out, we had 3 sounds, basically, that we could use. Yeah. And we had to come up with music based on these very limited kind of set of possibilities. And since then, both the game features, but also the tools that we use have developed a lot. And we have... Now it's possible to play a large variety of different styles of music and to freely express in a musical way what we want to express. On the other hand, I think that some things have remained unchanged in a way. It's still basically the same challenge to create music that will fit the game. It's also to create music that people will remember. And I think this is still a very similar challenge, even 25 years later.
And is it a similar job to writing film scores? These games have big story arcs. They have quite grand themes. It's quite operatic sometimes.
I think there are aspects which are similar and aspects which are different. Similar aspects, I mean, there are even movie scenes inside the game, which obviously are very similar to movies themselves. Certain key scenes will be just a running movie. And during those scenes, it's really about conveying the feeling or the atmosphere of that scene. There are some other needs that movie music does not necessarily have. One thing that we're really aiming for in games is that the player can have an immersive playing experience, and the music has to serve this purpose that the players can really kind of immerse into the game and into the story. The other thing is that our games have puzzles, fights, and have this sense of fulfillment when you solve a puzzle or the excitement of an ongoing battle. This is something that game music has to convey.
So you've really got to think of your audience a lot more than maybe if you just write a classical score. You've got to think about, yeah, how a character doesn't just go on one journey, he can go on 1,000 journeys in a computer game.
It's actually that when I create music or when we create music for a game, we think of the game as a whole, and all of the music in its entirety is for me the whole piece. So basically as the story evolves or the game progresses, you have kind of the entry point, then you have maybe the final boss battle will be the climax in terms of also of the music, and then you have the fulfillment after defeating the boss. And basically all of the music should fit with the game's theme and as a whole makes up the piece.
I wanted to ask how Kondo-san works. What's his office like at Nintendo? Is it a piano? How does he start off the creative process each time there's a new game or a new thing to write?
Actually,
that applies for the whole sound group team, which he manages. They all have a soundproof office, which is about the size of this, 1/6 of this room. So quite small, soundproof office with an electronic piano and a computer, and this is basically where we compose.
Is it to help all the other employees concentrate on the rest of their work then? Is that why they're soundproof?
That's one aspect, not to disturb other people, but it's also we want to be creating music in a similar environment that people will be listening to it. And they will, if we didn't have soundproof offices, we would have to use headphones, which is a different environment that most players will have.
And I wonder who Kondo San's classical influences are, whether some of his work bears out the sound of his musical heroes.
I do not know to what extent they influenced my work, but I'm very fond of Rachmaninoff, Tchaikovsky and Ravel, to name just three.
If Super Mario and Zelda were sort of operatic characters, who might they be?
Mario and Dark.
Really, I can't think of any figure or character in an opera. And I think probably more than Mario, Zelda would fit in an opera context.
Could employ the services of any musician in history to help him out, right, then score for the next computer game, who would it be?
I think that would be Bach, because he has a very large variety of music, and also I think it would be easy to interactive music applications with.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Koji Kondo, Nintendo's in-house composer and conductor of the Nintendo Orchestra. You're listening to the best of Monocle 24's cultural offering with me, Robert Bowne. Every week, we've encouraged our guests and colleagues to share some of their favourite writings with us, be it poetry or prose, record sleeve notes or recipes, in our imaginatively titled Book Corner. We've heard some brilliant stuff, but none could beat the oh-so-dulcet tones of the wonderful Simon Prosser from Hamish Hamilton and Penguin, who read a poignant pain to public libraries, a poem called Books by Billy Collins, from his selected poems, Taking Off Emily Dickinson's Clothes.
From the heart of this dark, evacuated campus, I can hear the library humming in the night. A choir of authors murmuring inside their books along the unlit alphabetical shelves. Giovanni Pontano next to Pope, Dumas next to his son, each one stitched into his own private coat, together forming a low, gigantic chord of language. I picture a figure in the act of reading, shoes on a desk, head tilted into the wind of a book. A man in two worlds, holding the rope of his tie as the suicide of lovers saturates a page. Or lighting a cigarette in the middle of a theorem. He moves from paragraph to paragraph, as if touring a house of endless panelled rooms. I hear the voice of my mother reading to me from a chair facing the bed, books about horses and dogs, and inside her voice lie other distant sounds, the horrors of a stable ablaze in the night, a bark that is moving towards the brink of speech. I watch myself building bookshelves in college, walls within walls, as rain soaks New England, or standing in a bookstore in a trench coat. I see all of us reading ourselves away from ourselves, straining in circles of light to find more light, until the line of words becomes a trail of crumbs that we follow across a page of fresh snow. When evening is shadowing the forest and small birds flutter down to consume the crumbs, we have to listen hard to hear the voices of the boy and his sister receding into the woods.
And that was Simon Prosser reading a poem called Books by Billy Collins, which is rather beautiful, actually. And you don't get that kind of thing all the time on every radio show, only on The Culture Show here on Monocle 24. And I wonder what you think of our bizarre, confusing and occasionally genius-like 1 minute of sound. Well, this time, our producer Katie Bilboa has worked her magic and cut a few up and glued them back together to create one very questionable aural experience.
Tell me when you're ready to go.
Okay.
Thank you.
I think that's okay. No, let's turn it down. I think that's okay now. No. Is it alright, Nick? Lots of loud noises. I'm not very technical, but we can tell.
That was our ultimate 1 minute of sound, at least for this year. So that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, it'll be 2012, a new year and a new start. So we'll be discussing how to get started in the creative industries. Whether you're a budding writer, artist or thespian, we'll be learning the tricks of the trade from the people who know best. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa and my researcher was Hannah Jenkins. And time for one final song this year. It is a cover. It's Lennon McCartney's Blackbird, covered by Billy Preston. This is a wild song. And by the way, there is a point to playing it because it's from a brand new compilation called Black America Sings Lennon McCartney Come Together. Thanks for tuning in.